Session number 11745, Sir Hugh Mackenzie, reel 4.
Admiral Mackenzie, reel 4.
conditions on board, on patrol in the Malacca Straits were really very unpleasant. The temperature of the sea was over 90 usually. The temperature on board in the submarine was around about 100. Humidity was extreme. We had no real proper air conditioning, no air conditioning at all, in fact. We had very little fresh water. We did have a distiller, but it was a copy of a German model and never worked very satisfactorily. A large proportion of the crew would be suffering from prickly heat. One's bunk was perpetually damp from just sweat. The smell must have been horrible. I suppose we were used to it and didn't notice it. And altogether, I cannot think of more unpleasant conditions for maintaining patrol. One saving grace, as far as I personally was concerned as the captain, was that every now and then, when on the surface at night, one ran into a tropical storm with absolute torrential rain, and one could strip off on the bridge, send for a bar of soap, and have a real good wash. But otherwise, for those who couldn't get on the bridge, do likewise, life must have been very unpleasant. Maybe that's how I never suffered from prickly heat myself personally. But then I was in the fortunate position of being able to do that. We found very few targets to attack in the Straits of Malacca. I only rarely had one successful torpedo attack, and that was on an escorted merchant ship, which was heading for the Andaman Islands from the Straits of Malacca. And we sighted it first from a cloud of smoke appearing over the horizon. And we were able to come to the surface and pursue this cloud of smoke, which erupted regularly at 20-minute intervals. And we chased this ship for 42 hours before we finally sank it. My first attack on it was abortive because it zigzagged at the last time and made us go deep and break off the attack. But we were able to surface after it had gone past and pursue it again. And thanks to the cloud of smoke regularly emitted at 20-minute intervals, we could always keep in touch with it. And as I say, eventually we sank it. Apart from that, I think we sank one or two small ships by gunfire. I remember one case where we were shooting at a tug on the north coast of Sumatra, a tug towing a couple of barges, and we'd surfaced and engaged it with the gun. It was inshore of us and close to the mouth of a fairly large river on the north coast of Sumatra, and it disappeared up this river and escaped us. We pursued it valiantly until I suddenly realized that the fishing stakes, which one sees all along that coast, were no longer going past me. They were stationary. I thought we were, you know, proceeding at high speed on the surface, chasing this tug. In fact, we were hard and fast aground. fortunately, the enemy weren't very active around us at the time, and we managed to get ourselves off the mud and back into deeper water. Anyway, come September 43, the Maidstone... 44. The Maidstone, which had been our depot ship at Trincomalee, left Trincomalee to go down to Fremantle in Western Australia, taking some of the Trincomalee-based submarines with her, including Tantalus. At that particular time, I was suffering from bruised or broken ribs, and unfit, accordingly, to go on patrol in Tantalus. So she went off with one of the spare COs, and I took passage to Australia in Maidstone, where I was very glad to see Tantalus come safely back about 5 weeks later. I then rejoined Tantalus, and we did our first patrol from October to December, 52 days, in the South China Sea. A very long haul from Fremantle. One went on the surface as far as the Lombok Strait, which is roughly between Bali and the next island to the east in the chain of the East Indies, the island chain. Went through the Lombok Strait, which was always heavily patrolled by Japanese forces, and then once inside in the Java Sea, one could get back on the surface again, and you could spend most of one's patrol in the Java Sea and South China Sea on the surface. There were very few Japanese anti-submarine air patrols, and one really only dived if you saw a suitable target coming along. Again, there was a great paucity of targets. The American submarines had virtually swept the China Sea and the South China Sea and the Java Sea clear of Japanese shipping in their two-year campaign, which I suppose is the most successful submarine campaign in history. We did have one or two occasional successes, but they were very long patrols. I found them rather frustrating that one could do 50 days on patrol and still come back with virtually all one's torpedoes on board. In this first patrol in October to December, we had orders that come November, from the 7th of November onwards, we were to go to a certain island about 100 miles south of Singapore, land two soldiers and see if they could make contact with a special party who'd gone up in to try and attack shipping in Singapore in a junk. And after the attack, the orders were that they would come back to this particular island and would be picked up any time after the 10th of November, 7th of November. In actual fact, come the 7th of November, I still had all torpedoes on board, and I asked permission to extend my patrol and delay the pickup, which was granted. And when we eventually went to this rendezvous, we landed our two soldiers one night, picked them up again the next night, but they found nobody on the island, and subsequent intelligence has revealed that the Japs had rumbled this special expedition before they got to Singapore. They'd had to disperse and try and make their individual escapes by foul boat down through the island chain. Some had got to the island we were due to pick them up from, but it again had been found by the Japanese before the 7th of November. And none of this particular party survived. I think it's one of the bravest operations that I'd heard of during the whole of the war. And it's a tragedy that none survived to tell the tale. Having come back from that patrol in December, we had Christmas in Fremantle. The Australians really were the most hospitable people that you can possibly imagine, and everyone on board had a whale of a time in Perth. And far wider afield than Perth. I myself went over to Adelaide to stay with friends, and we were flown by the Australian Air Force all over, right through to Sydney and so on. And had a quite marvellous spell in harbour. In fact, it was... A common saying was in our flotilla in Fremantle was that the Battle of Perth was far more dangerous and exhausting than the Battle of the Pacific. And in many ways it was, but quite a different sort. There's one particular episode of that patrol in October, December. We sank one small ship by gunfire, picked up the crew who were largely Malays or East Indonesians, and subsequently transferred them to the first junk we came across, because we couldn't carry them all on board. But we also pulled out of the sea a Japanese soldier who'd been the armed guard on board this ship we'd sunk. We had great difficulty in catching him because he kept on trying to swim away from us and to try and maneuver a submarine to catch a swimmer who is determined to try and swim away from you. It was not easy, but we got him on board on the end and we kept him as a prisoner. He became a mascot almost. We gave him a daily task to do so that he wouldn't get too bored, which was to polish a ration of valve hand wheels. Well, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of valves in a submarine with hand wheels. And by the time we got back into harbour in December, he had practically every valve hand wheel in Tantalus burnished, gleaming. The day we arrived in harbour was the day when the commander-in-chief of the British Pacific Fleet, which was then forming, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser, flew into Perth, and of course he came on board, the only British ship in harbour then, the submarine depot ship, and he was asked if he'd like to come on board Tantalus. We'd just come in that morning, come in from patrol. And I think our captain, SM, must have thought that we were, you know, we'd be in a pretty filthy state, and warned the commander-in-chief that not to expect too much. In actual fact, when he came on board and walked through the ship, there we were, gleaming, almost ready for an admiral's inspection, thanks to our Japanese prisoner. As the commander-in-chief had seen us during our working up in August the year before, because we'd laid alongside his flagship, the Duke of York, when he was CNC Home Fleet in Scarpa, and he'd come on board us then, it was very nice to see him again. We also had, as a member of our crew, a New Zealander whose relations actually lived in Sydney. Admiral Fraser heard of this and straight away said that he would fly this leading stoker in his aeroplane to Sydney the next day for special leave, which was typical of Bruce Fraser, actually.
What kind of a man was he?
What, this leading stoker?
Bruce Fraser.
Bruce Fraser? Oh, he was a marvellous man, I think. Quite marvellous. Very unassuming, very quiet, very friendly, ready to talk to anybody. When we'd lain alongside Duke of York during our working up in August 43, he asked me, my first lieutenant and engineer officer, all to have dinner with him in the Admiral's quarters. And I've always said it was the best dinner of the whole war that I ever had. And he then put his sea cabin up in the bridge structure of the Duke of York at my disposal for the rest of the time we were in the harbour. I would have gone anywhere for that man. Mark you, at that time I was just a very junior lieutenant commander. So on to 1945. Our last and final patrol in Tantalus, we left Fremantle in January and got back in March. We were away for 55 days. And I think returned with all our torpedoes, with just no targets to see at all. We had one exciting interlude, though, off the east coast of Malaya, where we were patrolling on the surface in about 20 fathoms of water, which was about as shallow as one wanted to go. You didn't want to get into much shallow water if you had to dive. When we sighted inshore of us the smoke of a ship coming south, it was to the north of us. I looked at the chart, and quite clearly, if we were going to attack it, we would have to go into about 10 fathoms of water. And I found on the chart a little patch, a little circle marked 12 fathoms, which seemed to be right in the path of the ship. So we nipped inshore there and dived in this 12-fathom patch. And sure enough, along came this, what looked very smart, about 5,000-ton merchant ship, escorted by a destroyer, one on each bow. And we were in a nice position to attack, and everything was going beautifully. We were almost all ready to fire torpedoes at it. And we were just inshore of it, that is, on its starboard bow as it was steaming south, when the destroyer on its starboard, between us and it, and watching it fairly carefully through the periscope, it was only about 1,000 yards away, hoisted a string of flags and altered course straight at us. At the same time, our ASDIG operator reported that the destroyer seemed to be in contact with its ASDIG. Put the periscope down, and we went deep and hit the bottom with 43 feet on the gauge. The destroyer came straight over us. We all held our breath. Nothing happened. Turned round, came back again, still in ASDIC contact, dropped a string of, I think, 6 depth charges. Not very close, fortunately, or it had gone straight over the top of us. Turned round, went over us again, I think, and I think it dropped another 3 charges or 4 charges, and then went off. We, meanwhile, had been sort of grovelling along in the mud or on the bottom. Once it had gone, obviously it had gone clear, we came back to periscope depth, and everything, of course, was heading away to the south out of range, and that was a failed attack. But we were very lucky to get away with that one. But that was really the only exciting incident in the whole of that patrol, except for a brief glimpse of 2 Japanese battleships, which were the last remnants of the Japanese fleet in Singapore, heading north towards the Philippines. We got an ultra message giving roughly the positions they would go through. We tried to intercept them. All we saw were their pagoda-like structures on the horizon, steaming north, surrounded by a cloud of aircraft, one of which detached itself, came straight at us, made us dive while we were trying desperately on the surface to get ahead of this lot, dropped a bomb on us, and that ruined all hope of us getting in an attack on the only Japanese battleships I ever saw.
You say you received an ultra message. Did you know the source of this intelligence, that it was from cracking enemy?
We guessed it. We didn't know at the time. The same applies to that ultra message about that ship in June 42, which I sank in the Thrasher.
You thought it would be for signals intelligence?
Well, I knew from my experience in working in the staff office in Medway when I was the spare CO that we were getting this signal, SIGINT. But one kept very quiet about it. Anyway, that at the end of that patrol, Tantalus got back to Fremantle the end of March 45. We'd done over another 11,000 miles in that patrol. Our engines were packing up. We were virtually on one engine only from the Lombok Straits back to Fremantle, partially trying to save fuel, because as we came through Lombok Straits, we were told that the refueling barge in Exmouth Gulf, which we would have called in at 1,000 miles north of Fremantle, had been blown ashore by a typhoon and was no longer available. So we had to make the final journey on one engine to save fuel at slow speed in order to get back at all.
That really brings my war to an end. We sailed in Chancellor's for the United Kingdom in April 45. We were in Portside on VE Day and got back to Portsmouth about the beginning of June. Subsequently went up to Dundee, where Tantalus was refitted, and I left her in July 45.